That's right.
On no weariness, nor death, nor trouble.
That's right.
So then, in this context, what's your definition of vain or idle imaginings?
It is false self-concept. We each have a false self-concept, and that's what the vain imagining is. You see? Let's talk about that. I was going to talk about this later on, but I can talk about it now. I can sort of inverse the order, because I was definitely going to talk about this. You see, the human being has three basic capacities, which is the knowledge or understanding capacity, the heart or feeling capacity, and the will. And the achievement of this consciousness of communion with God is a process in which we activate our capacities for knowing, for feeling, and for willing in such a way that we increase them. We become more knowledgeable, more loving, and more autonomous. In other words, the overall direction of spiritual progress is increasing well-being, and increasing autonomy. Increasing well-being and increasing autonomy. Now, past moral educational systems and past religions put the emphasis on the increasing well-being, which is just a fancy name for happiness, okay? You get happier, you feel better and better. So, in the past dispensations, the emphasis was almost wholly on the first goal of increasing happiness. So, you do this by avoiding eternal damnation, by being saved, by being one of the believers who is happy because he has accepted the truth, and so on and so on. Although the past prophets clearly had a belief in the autonomy of the individual, the educational systems, the ideological systems that grew up on the basis of these teachings, the systems that were contrived by the leaders of religion, denied this autonomy. They tried to suppress this autonomy. This is the catechism in the Catholic Church. This is all of the fatwas of the mullahs and all of this stuff. In other words, the idea was that your goal is to be happy, and you are happy by following exactly all these rules that we have for you to follow. Okay? And the worst thing you can do is to start thinking about these rules, and especially questioning them. Okay? So, the Baha'i system of moral education puts an equal weight on autonomy as well as increased in well-being, because it sees this as a process. Okay? A process of increasing your autonomy. What this means is simply that learning is going on two levels. You're learning new things, and you're learning how to learn new things. In other words, you're learning how to learn as you learn. The learning how to learn is a second order kind of learning, and that's what I call autonomy, increasing autonomy. In other words, as you go through this cycle, you not only increase your virtues and powers, as Shoghi Effendi says, okay, but you increase your ability to get more virtues and powers. As you learn how to learn. As you make progress, you learn how to make more progress. So, Baha'u'llah has now taken the veil away from this process. And he has showed us what the ultimate goal is, which is an increase not only in our happiness, but in our autonomy. And the two are linked. the two are linked. Now, each one of us, as we grow up, we construct an inner model of reality. We construct an inner model of reality. So here we are, here each human being is, okay? And there's the world outside of himself. And he interacts with the world outside of himself. It acts on him, he reacts to it, he also initiates actions and so on. So this process of education or spiritual development or moral development is a process of interaction. Now, I assume that there is a basic unit of interaction, which I call an instantiation, okay? But be that as it may, in other words, an instantiation is an interaction that is localized in time. There are two kinds of localization. You can localize in space or you can localize in time, okay? Localizing in space gives you a position, a point. Localizing in time gives you an instant, okay? So you can think of your life then as a series of instances, okay? You have one now, and then the next one, and then the next one, and so on, okay? Now, in fact, it is now known that physiological perception is a series of cliches, exactly like this. There are waves that are emitted by the thalamus that sweep over the entire brain about 1,000 times a second, regularly. And the information of perception, you're looking at me, the blueness of my shirt, my shape, which, like Monty Python's dinosaur, is thin at one end, fat in the middle, and thin at the other end. And so on. All of this data is stored in your brain in different locations. It is not physically located in your brain. It is dispersed in the brain physically. But you don't have the impression of having disparate perceptions of me. It's all one thing. And that's because at regular intervals, this wave emitted by the thalamus sweeps over the brain and discharges this data in each of these receptors. And so you take just like an instant photograph, like a cliche, like a cinema. And this goes on 1,000 times a second. So it is now known for sure that physiological perception is a cinema. It is a series of cliches. In other words, there is an irreducible unit of perception in time. Well, so undoubtedly the interactions of the soul are continuous. They're not discrete. However, we can assume, for purposes of understanding the process of spiritual growth, that they are discrete. And in this life, they are physiologically discrete, and since we operate through our bodies in this life, it is a reasonable assumption to make. So think of your life as a series of interactions. So what do? You start out what? You start out totally unconscious. So notice that the path of development for every human being is the same. It is this parabola, this arc, okay? We emerge from unconsciousness, okay? We develop physically to a highest point, and then we decline and die. This is the physical development, okay? This is the physical development. We emerge from unconsciousness. We emerge from unconsciousness. So we construct, through these interactions, an inner model of reality. So let's think of the newborn baby. What is the model of reality he's making under normal circumstances? Well, he feels hungry. He cries. And then somebody picks him up, and a warm breast is put in his mouth, and he gets nourished, and he feels warm, and he feels loved, and so on and so on. And then this process is repeated. In a couple of hours, he gets hungry again, and so on. So already he's learning two things. He's learning life is a place where you have needs, and that can be bad, because when you have a need, like you're hungry, you don't feel good. but it's a place where your needs can be satisfied. So in other words, the human condition is that we are needful creatures. We're needful creatures. And so we strive to fulfill our needs. And Baha'u'llah explains to us that God has provided a legitimate way of satisfying all of our needs. So we can already say that what unspiritual behavior is either the lack of satisfaction of our legitimate needs, or else the false satisfaction, that is, the illegitimate attempt to satisfy our needs in some way, such as taking drugs to feel good about yourself or something like that, okay? You're trying to satisfy a need which may be legitimate, but you're doing it in an illegitimate way. Now, of course, that would be a perfect definition of hell, right? If God had wanted to torture us, he certainly could have done it. Namely, all he has to do is produce in us needs that are incapable of satisfaction, right? Can you think of a better definition of hell than that? To live eternally with some need that you can never satisfy, right? So, we are needful creatures. God loves us infinitely. Therefore, he has provided for the legitimate satisfaction of all our needs. But we have to learn. We are not born with the knowledge of how to satisfy these needs legitimately. We have to learn how to do it. Well, so we make a model of reality. We make a model of reality, an inner model of reality in our heads here. But this model of reality, in the first place, it is bound to be based on partial information because we're not God, we're finite human beings. We only have a finite, limited amount of information about anything, right? So the best we can do is generalize on the basis of the information we have. So if our parents are kind and loving to us, we may presume that all parents are kind and loving, and later on we may discover that there are parents who are abusive and hateful and cruel or whatever, okay? Or if we happen to be, unfortunately, those who are born to parents who are hateful and cruel and loving, we may presume that all parents are like that or all adults are like that, unless and until we are fortunate enough to find out that this isn't the case, all right? Whatever. But so, our model is bound to be distorted and limited because it is based on partial information. So we're continually correcting this model. We're continually getting new information and correcting this model. Okay? But that's not all. Because we have needs, because we face this problem of building a model of reality on the basis of our needs, we are not disinterested spectators. We need to know how to fulfill our need. Therefore, we are going to do what psychologists call project. We're going to project on reality on the basis of our needs. That is, we're going to distort the information we have from reality. This is what I call need-generated distortion. In other words, this need-generated distortion can take roughly one of two forms. We can either deny the existence, we can blot out the existence of certain unpleasant things that are there, but we don't want them to be there, so we try not to see them and we repress them or we avoid them or we deny their existence. Or else, we see things that aren't there. In other words, we interpret things in such a way that creates unrealistic expectations about reality, that things are always going to be a certain way because they've always been that way or whatever. So these need-generated distortions of reality are the vain imaginings. They're vain because they're generated by our ego, by our selfish needs. And they are imaginings because they're in our head. They are not the reality, but they are distortions of reality. But the point is this. We act not on the basis of the reality, but on the basis of our inner model of reality. because we can't act on anything else. In other words, that's the way you see reality, you see. You can't say, think of this, you can't look at reality and say, I see this wall is blue, but I know it's really red. You see, you can't possibly say that, because if the wall really was red, all right, and you knew that it was red, then you couldn't perceive it as blue, okay? You couldn't perceive it as blue. So that's the problem with these vain imaginings, is that we take them to be reality, because to us they are reality. That's the way we see reality. But, so, the process of purification is the process by which we come to perceive the dissonance between reality and our inner model of reality. And this permits us to discard the vain illusioning and replace the faulty part of our picture with a true part of our picture. Does this make any sense? Okay. Now, you see, the vain part of it has to do with the fact that not only are we making an inner model of the world out there, we're also making an inner model of ourselves, of our own reality. And this is what we call self-concept. In other words, we have a concept not only of human beings in general and the world in general and the way it works, if it's pleasant or unpleasant or good or evil or whatever and whatever. You know, are people generally friendly or trustworthy, or, you know, are people generally untrustworthy and aggressive or whatever, you know? And so if people tend to think that everybody is untrustworthy and aggressive, we say, well, he's a paranoid person or whatever, okay? And if a person tends to think that everybody's trustworthy and nice, then we say he's naive or whatever, and so on, okay? We have these things, but we also have the concept about ourself. And in particular, about our value or worth, self-worth or value. Now, this is so important because the concept of what we are and what we're worth is largely derived from other people's view of what we are. Right? In other words, and especially like when you're young, you know, what your parents and the people you interacted with thought of you, and later on other people. Now, so let's imagine, say, a young child who loves to sing spontaneously, and her mother, for whatever reason, this, say, irritates the mother. The mother says, why do you always make those grotesque sounds? Can't you just shut up and leave me in peace or whatever? So the child may very well internalize the notion, well, I have an unpleasant voice and I shouldn't sing. It may objectively be the case that the child has a very pleasant voice, even maybe has a talent for singing. But the child will have to unlearn this negative self-concept that has been generated by this other person's evaluation, you see. So the point is, the drama is that the most important part of our inner model is our self-concept. And this is the part of our inner model which is most susceptible to distorted information from other people. And it's most dependent on the approval of other people. Well, it's unfortunate unless we use it in the way God intended it to be used. Why is it that the child needs the approval of his parents? Well, in the first place, because his day-to-day survival depends on his approval of his parents. If his parents disapprove of him sufficiently, maybe they'll abandon him. So the child knows this. So that's the first rule in dealing with a young child. If given a choice between the approval of his parents and anything else, the child will choose the approval of his parents. Okay, because he knows that his survival depends on the approval of his parents. Well, but you see, this is a feature that was given by God in order for us to train children in the love and fear of God. In other words, what we should do is use this to show the child that we ourselves as parents are subject to a higher law, that we seek the approval of God. and that we should all seek the approval of God. So we should, in effect, say to the child, it is not my approval that you need, but the approval of God. And here is what I've discovered about how to obtain the approval of God. I will share this with you, and I will help you, but I am subject to this higher law just as much as you are. I can do nothing but explain this law to you. I didn't create it, and so on. The problem comes, the power struggle comes when the parents substitute their will and desires for the law of God, you see. Then it becomes a power struggle, then it becomes authoritarian, and so on. You see, that's different. Okay, so you see, again, you can deplore these features, and of course we've all suffered from them because none of us were raised by perfect parents. We've all suffered from them. But these are features which God has built into the system because they have the greatest potential for the good. Because when properly used, they will produce what Baha'u'llah has talked about, young children and babies who know more than the greatest scholars, and so on and so on. In other words, when these are used in the correct way, they will produce an immense amount of progress in a short period of time. So this notion of self-worth. Now, what I have come to believe, and Gordon referred to this morning, and I'll just maybe end up with a few statements about this. What time are we going to?
I'm having a break now. I'm going to 4:30.
Okay. Well, let me just get in one or two more ideas before the break, and then we'll take a break and so on. You see, now, I believed up until a few years ago that we derived most of our notion of self-worth from our relationship with our parents, which is sort of the Freudian view, or the psychoanalytic view. And this, this of course, is, as you sort of reacted to, is somewhat frightening, right? It's sort of frightening because it seems so arbitrary. I mean, people can be so different, so this means sort of like everybody is totally subject to their parents' plans and all. I've come to believe that this is not the case, that there are certain very general pervasive features of our society which largely determine our notion of self-worth and which are transmitted by the parents but which have very little to do with the idiosyncrasies of the parents, whether the parents are one way or the other. And so I just want to throw out these ideas and then we'll take our break. One is the collectivist notion. The collectivist notion, which is that the individual has no intrinsic value. He has value only insofar as he plays some role in society, that he gets all of his value from the society. Now, what collectivism leads to is the pursuit of power. You have to pursue power. You have to pursue power because that's the only way you can compel somebody to recognize your worth. I mean, nobody can accept that he's worth nothing. I mean, if you really accept in your deepest soul that you're worth nothing, then you commit suicide. I mean, you know. So you can't accept that you're worth nothing, but since the only way you can get a value, if you subscribe to the collectivist view, unconsciously or not, is that you get it from society, and the only way you can get it from society is by compelling, having a status in society which enables you to compel others to recognize your value. And so this leads to the pursuit of power. The other extreme is individualism. Which says that people have value, people can have individual value, but only to the extent that they exhibit special competency in some respect. So individualism leads to competition. Now, of course, unfortunately, nothing prevents the marriage of both of these. So you can very well have a society, which we do, which has features both of the pursuit of power and competition, which is the worst of all possible worlds, so to speak. So these are tendencies. So collectivism is, of course, the social tendency, say, in Russia. And the pursuit of power is absolutely the leitmotif, was the leitmotif of Soviet society. Pursuing of power in every respect. And North American society tends to be more individualistic, and what we see is competition. Now, what is spiritually destructive about competition is the following thing. You see, competition is the way you demonstrate special competence. In other words, how can I prove that I can play the violin better than you? Well, you play the violin, I play the violin, other people observe, and they say, you know, we see who can outperform the other. We observe, you know. So competition means we strive to outperform each other, all right? Now, this competition is often pervaded under the name of the pursuit of excellence. But in fact, it has nothing to do whatsoever with the pursuit of excellence. The pursuit of excellence is, if you will, comparison between my performance at two different times, right? In other words, if I can play the violin better tomorrow than I did today, that's pursuit of excellence. Whether I can play the violin better than you may not say anything about excellence, okay? But depending on our relative abilities about playing the violin, I mean, maybe you're no good at all, in which case the fact that I can play better than you has no meaning whatsoever. Or maybe you are a world-class violinist, in which case the fact that you can play the violin much better than me, again, says nothing about me, about my pursuit of excellence. So pursuit of excellence is the vertical pursuit. It is the comparison of different performances by the same individual at different times. Competition is the horizontal comparison of performances of different individuals at the same time, okay? So you can see competition is the comparison of different performances at the same time. Pursuit of excellence is the comparison of different performances by the same individual at different times. So these are perpendicular to each other. They're not the same thing at all. Now, people say, well, does not competition stimulate the pursuit of excellence? Well, let's look at it. Suppose you and I are both striving to play the violin. Now, we may very well compare our performances as we pursue excellence. But if I am only interested in playing the violin better than you, then I have two strategies. One strategy is the pursuit of excellence. I can say, well, I'll improve my performance, and therefore I'll play better than you. But on the other hand, you can also pursue excellence, in which case I have no guarantee that even if I improve my performance substantially, you don't also improve your performance substantially. So I have no guarantee that I will play better than you. Now, of course, if we're just pursuing excellence, that won't matter. The world is much better off with two good violin players than one good one and one bad one, right? So if we're all pursuing excellence, there's no problem. But if we are in competition, if it is dominance that we're seeking and not just pursuit of excellence, then improving my performance is not the best strategy. What is the best strategy? You know what it is. It's sabotage. The best strategy is for me to sabotage your performance. That's a sure way of being sure that I will play better than you. So competition produces sabotage. It produces disunity, to use a Baha'i word. A competitive society generates disunity because it puts everybody in a competitive instead of a cooperative relationship. Okay? And that's what our society does. Now, competition also is I say, values only the exceptional. The ordinary is not valued. You see? So in order to achieve a value, you have to excel at something in our society. If you don't excel, if you're ordinary, I mean, that's the worst thing, right, in our society, to be considered ordinary. I mean, no, seriously, can you think of anything worse than being considered ordinary in our society? Ordinary. He's just an ordinary person. You know, what contempt for ordinariness, right? I mean, much better to be the king of the mafia than an ordinary person, right? Okay. So, we pay millions of dollars to gorillas who knock little rubber pucks in nets, okay? Because this is excellence, all right? Or we pay millions of dollars to Madonna because she can take her clothes off in public better than anybody else, right? But we don't pay too much attention to ordinary things like motherhood, right? Now, think about this one. What could be more ordinary than motherhood, right? I mean, anybody of the female sex can become a mother, right? It's very easy to be a mother. In fact, in our society, the greatest preoccupation today is how to avoid becoming a mother, right? No, I mean, okay? So, becoming a mother is an ordinary thing. There's nothing extraordinary about that. Nobody's going to give you any points for being a mother. It's very ordinary. Now look, observe the interaction between mothers and their children. From the time a child is born until the child has become independent, the mother, at every instant of her life, will give priority to the needs of that child over her own needs. Observe, go out and look at any ordinary mother. I'm talking about the most ordinary mother you can find, okay? But you look at the interaction between the mother and her child, and you will see that instantaneously, as soon as the mother perceives the child has a need, she will forget her own need and attend to the need of the child. Pretend 15 years. Maybe for a whole life, I mean, okay? That's a pretty extraordinary thing, isn't it? Now, not only is it extraordinary, it's the future of the whole human race. I mean, all it would take would be for one generation of mothers to refuse to do that, and that would be the end of the human race. Huh? We could do a long time without Madonna and hockey stars, right? But we couldn't do very long without mothers. And yet our society gives immense value to hockey stars. Why? Because it's special. Because it's out of the ordinary. You see, it devalues the ordinary and supervalues the extraordinary. This is the distortion that is rent by a competitive society. The result is a pervasive sense of negative self-worth. In other words, do mothers feel appreciated for the sacrifices they make in our society? No. Are they appreciated? No, they aren't appreciated. Okay? No wonder they don't feel appreciated. They aren't appreciated. All right? They're taken for granted. Not only are they taken for granted, they're criticized and blamed for every little blip in the behavior of their kids. All right? So, you see, we have to get some hold on the degree of distortion, how pathological this is, you see. How totally pathological it is. It's utterly pathological. Reread the Kitāb-i-Aqdas in the light of this discussion. You'll see that the marriage relationship, the family is right at the heart of the thing. Baha'u'llah recreates the whole of society as an extended family. Motherhood is the most important function, okay? The education of children is the most important function, okay? So this again then goes back to the vain imaginings. The vain imaginings are all of these false self-concepts that you have, that in order to get worth, you have to be extraordinary, that you have to excel in some area of endeavor and so on, instead of cooperate and help and serve other people and so on, okay? That's false. That's vain imagining, you see. Okay, well, let's let it go at that.
So about 15 minutes.
Okay. In the language of the holy books, and by using this knowledge to avail ourselves of the special conditions of this material world, we can progress spiritually. So you see, when Shoghi Effendi says that this world is a womb for the next world, he's speaking with exact scientific precision. This is not a loose analogy. Exactly, it functions in exactly the same way. The counterpart of the genetic code is the teachings of the manifestations, which are encoded in the holy books and passed down from generation to generation. And the conditions of this world, mainly the suffering that results from the tension of opposites, provides the resistance, the special conditions, which enable us to develop spiritually at a very fast rate, if we avail ourselves of this condition. Yeah. No, I think you did, actually.
Right. But my question was concerning reincarnation. Personally, I'm really glad that the Bahá'u'lláh says reincarnation doesn't exist, and we do progress.
And not only am I glad that he said it, but I'm glad that it doesn't exist.
Yeah. But so many people are very firm in their belief in the reality of reincarnation.
That's true. That's right.
What you would say to that question?
Well, you see, one has to distinguish between what the truth is and how you persuade somebody of what the truth is. My experience with people who believe in reincarnation is that it's very difficult to dissuade them of this. So I have to confess that I now very rarely try. Okay? So I simply say to them, here is what we Baha'is believe, that we come to this life only once, okay? And so I simply use this. You see, we make this once more. Baha'u'llah says, well, science tells us that the human physical body is the most highly ordered, the most complex physical structure that exists. I mean, we know this. Okay. The writings go one step more. That's science. That's bottom up. We observe. We observe. Look. Look at everything there is. The most complex thing is the human body. Nobody argues with this. Everybody knows it's true. But then revelation, which is top down, adds something. It tells us, not only is the human body the most complex structure that exists, it is the most complex structure that could exist in the material world. Because it is the temple of the soul. So it is only fitting that the human body is the most complex, the most subtle entity that it is possible to make with material elements. So this is also a sort of consolation, right? It doesn't get any cruder than this, I mean, than this world. There's no world below this one, you know. So, the human physical body is the apogee of material creation. So, it rests at this topmost point of an ascending arc. The soul of man is the lowest thing in the spiritual world, because the manifestation and God are higher than the soul of man. And the soul of man comes from God. It is created by God, and it comes from God. And it begins its ascending arc from the lowest point in the spiritual world. In fact, what could be lower than total unconsciousness, which is the state we all start out in, right? I mean, you were not aware immediately after you existed. Your self-awareness, your awareness of your being only came about after several years of life experience. So this is the human reality. It is the highest, it is the intersection, it is the touch point of the highest point of physical creation and the lowest point of spiritual creation. So this completes the creation. The completeness is one of the, there are several principles by which God creates. One is a kind of an optimization principle, but another is a completeness principle, which answers, incidentally, the question that so many people ask about, well, if God, you know, really created all this, why did he create, you know, flies and mosquitoes and all of this stuff and so on and so on? Well, one of the purposes of God in creating is to show, you know, why did he create dinosaurs, which then become extinct and so on? One thing is that he created to show what it is possible to do with material elements, to show the whole range of possible forms of creation.